Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. My guest today is Julie Oberdovic. She is the author of a book, An Unfortunate Coincidence. I read that book cover to cover. It's a riveting story of her journey with her daughter and autism. She's also a high school teacher, so has insights from that world and is active in the health freedom movement. Dee Dee's going to round this out with a discussion of mom to mom, what it's like, and you get to really get to know Julie. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My heart is so full, having just gone through an experience of being a grandpa again. So when we're in the clinic and Dee Dee's doing body work or massage on babies, and I get to interact with babies, it is one of the most enjoyable and fun times in my day. Babies are amazing. I want to just kind of give a shout out tribute to Aja and Nick for pulling off what few are able to pull off. They had a home birth, their first child. The pregnancy was running late, and they had the peace and calm and determination and courage to stay calm and just move through the process. And, you know, you hear, I'm in awe of women who can do this, honestly. I guess women are just naturally designed to be able to do this incredible process of bringing a new life into the world when, of course, there's pain involved and there's physical challenges. But she stayed calm, she stayed focused, she stayed, you know, present. And she had help. I think her husband was by her side as much as he could be. And she had a doula, a birth person who was able to also just guide that whole process. And the beautiful outcome of a healthy baby girl and getting to hold her. And when you hold that precious life, that there's an innocence and a beauty, and you just know that something miraculous has happened. And it was just so beautiful to see it happen without all the typical hospital interventions that in the past I would go to the hospital to see newborns. There's just something really magical about that, something very loving and special. And babies thrive on connection. So they hear their parents' voices. That baby needs that skin time and doesn't leave their parents' side or their body, really. They have held and nurtured that baby from moment one. And so to all of you out there who are going to have a child, are having a child, I send you my love and blessings from my heart to yours, that you can just love on that baby that's coming, that gift that's coming into your world, that it can be as peaceful as possible. Welcome, Julie Oberdovic. It is so great to have this ability to talk to you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited. It's been a long time.
It has. You are now a contributing editor of the Age of Autism blog. In fact, that's where I got reconnected to you. It was like, oh my gosh, you're a founding member of the Canary Party. And where you and I connected was over your book, and An Unfortunate Coincidence, A Mother's Life Inside the Autism Controversy. Yeah. And you sent me an advanced copy, which I read every word. I just pulled it off and there it is. It's still in my library. And actually, that book is still relevant. I was just looking through it again and looking at all my underlines. Obviously, you share your journey and we're going to get into that a bit. But you also, part of your journey was this incredible job of trying to figure out what the heck's going on. How did we get here? And that's all covered in this book. So for somebody who maybe on their own is still early in that journey, they've got a child, maybe they're worried about autism or they've been diagnosed with autism, they're wondering, where do I go? What's happened? It's a nice book.
Thank you. Yeah. When I was approached to write it, I really thought about what I wanted the legacy to be, if anything. And it was that I know beyond all doubt that we are living in this remarkably unique period in human history where this issue is concerned. And that I was even a part of it 20 years ago. I was at the cusp of it, if you will.
Yeah.
And I knew that my experience was extremely unique. And I knew that our voices and our experiences were being rewritten by people with a different viewpoint, let's put it that way. And it was extremely important to me to capture what it was really like to be a part of this from 2004, 2005. And what the journey was actually all about, not only experiencing what had happened to my daughter, but like you said, how did I come to this conclusion? What was the evidence? What was happening politically and scientifically at the time that led me to this? So it was selfish more than anything. I honestly really wanted to just be like, look, not crazy. This is the information. This is what happened. And wherever this leads is maybe out of my hands, but I want it to be documented that this was the other side.
Yeah. And thank you for doing that. I recall in the initial part of that book, you share your story with your daughter, Emma. And Oh my gosh, as a busy pediatrician, I heard that story hundreds of times. You had the Hep B shot in the hospital. You had antibiotics after antibiotics. You had lots of vaccines, Tylenol. And then I remember reading your description of what I now call vaccine eyes. And after that 1 year visit, you describe just that blank stare you saw in her eyes.
Yep.
And when you're around kids who are vaccine affected or vaccine injured, it's real common to see that. There's just nobody home, right?
Nobody was home.
That followed that 1 year. I think it was around the 1 year visit where somehow, unfortunately, she was given the DTaP, Prevnar, polio, and MMR all at once.
All at once, yeah.
And essentially, you lost your little girl.
Yeah. I know everybody's journey is a little bit different. Ours was not an acute thing. That was the capstone event, if you will. But like you said, the first thing that happened with her was her immune system just seemed to become completely taxed. She was not able to fight anything that the rest of us were fighting off without any problem. And like you said, it was just constant Tylenol, antibiotics, then it was ear surgery, and all the while losing skills and never crawling and losing muscle tone. And then, like you said, the big event, if you will, just apparently, and I wasn't there for the night that it happened, high-pitched scream, arched back, just like they talk about. And within a day or two, recognizing she's not talking, she's not responding to me anymore. And like you said, just looking through you, just as if you're not there.
Yeah, that's got to be hard. Even still, this is 2 decades ago almost.
It is. Writing the book was extremely cathartic. I didn't appreciate, I don't think, how dramatically I was impacted emotionally until I went through that. It wasn't that I didn't realize it. It's just, I talk about it in the book. I'm very much of the mindset when the house is on fire, you get out and you cry about it later. And so I'm very practical in that way. But when later came, later comes for all of us. And when later came, it was really hard. But writing the book seemed to be such a healing process. I cried my eyes out writing that book and having to dig deep and revisit those moments and that pain. And it's not just that moment, right? It's a whole life. She's 22 right now, almost 23. And these challenges, although her life is remarkable, they'll still be with her for the rest of her life. And it's grieving the what if, right? It's grieving the woulda, coulda, shoulda. It's reconciling the guilt that you feel. Anyone can tell you all day long it's not your fault. And you understand that on an intellectual level, but on an emotional level, that's a very different thing to deal with.
Yeah. No, I get that. My kids were vaccine affected, thankfully not severe autism. One of my kids, it was getting there. How is Emma doing now?
She's doing wonderfully. She has the job. She works almost full time. She has a boyfriend who she goes and visits in Florida. In fact, just yesterday, she got back from a visit with him. And so she's doing a lot of things independently. She has always been the child who I've been more cautious. I'm very protective of her, and I think understandably so, but she's always trying to assert her independence and kind of balancing that line of where do we let her try to do things and that at the same time protect her. That has not always been easy, but she's happy. She's for the most part healthy. We do have some issues, particularly endocrine issues, believe it or not, which maybe makes sense given everything. But in terms of her immune system, in terms of her speech, having friends, being social, we really hit the lottery.
Wow.
Compared to what I thought that was going to be.
Yeah.
Really, well, different life.
And I think that's important for parents to know too, that recovery is not 100%, but it's a massive recovery from what you're saying.
Yes.
Because I do have families who are in my practice who have kids that same age who are still nonverbal and need 24/7 care.
Yeah, we were never in that severe of a situation, but it was certainly still terrifying, frightening. Even in fifth grade, there was talk about having to possibly take guardianship of her. So to be where we are and to live the life that we live, is, it's never lost on me how lucky we are, how blessed we are.
Yeah. Was having Emma in your life what actually got you involved in this issue, or are there other parts of the story?
Oh, no, that was 100%. Like you, this is not really an issue you want to go insert yourself in. This was certainly not where I was going to raise my hand and say, hey, well, let me rise to the top of this issue. It was quite the opposite, actually. My journey into this topic was kicking and screaming, to be honest with you. 20 years ago, we were on Yahoo chat rooms, right? Things have really changed. And within the Yahoo chat room for a group of parents of children with speech delay is where I started to hear about vaccines being a concern. And initially, I would delete them quite angry. I would be like, what is wrong with these people? This is so irresponsible. And it wasn't until I heard about the Homeland Security Act, which, again, for people that are new to this issue because of COVID, I just feel so passionately, gosh, there's two decades worth of really important information that people don't have. So I'll still keep speaking out about it for that reason. But for me, it was the Homeland Security Act, and just reading that there was a rider that was placed in there to protect Eli Lilly from any future lawsuits that came out about thimerosal, that just really piqued my interest. I didn't know what thimerosal was, but I certainly knew that it was very odd that a pharmaceutical company would have a senator who remained anonymous. It eventually ended up being Dick Armey, but who got somebody to anonymously insert liability protection for a pharmaceutical ingredient was just so out there. And that's what led me down the rabbit hole. And once I started looking and started connecting with other parents and putting the pieces together, you can't unsee it. It's just one of those things. You can't unsee it. And then trust me, there's been times I wish I could unsee it. I wish I could go back to believing the narrative and just hoping that everything is better diagnosis. It's just not. And simultaneously, I'm an educator. I've been in education for almost 30 years. And I was at the high school level, I still am, when this happened with my daughter. And that was around 2000. Like I said, she was born in 2001. So it was around 2003, 4, and 5 when I started to look into things. And we at the high school level had not been hit by the epidemic yet. There was a very clear moment at the end of the early 2000s, around 2008, 2009, where for the very first time, we had someone come as an autism specialist.
Into the high school level.
What that was. Yes. So my family, who had been in education at the elementary school level, they had been sounding the alarm for a little while, but we had not seen the wave at the high school level. And so I taught through the wave. I started teaching in 1996. I can tell you emphatically, I would state under oath on a Bible, I did not have children with autism in my classroom on any sort of scale or level, or with even Asperger's or anything like that until around 2010, somewhere around there. Yep. It just wasn't there.
That would reflect injury if we're going to make the association, at least, between vaccines and injury occurring for high school age. You're talking, what, 12, 13-year-olds? 14-year-olds?
14? Yeah, 14 is when they start, right.
14 from, so that takes us back into the late 1990s?
The early 90s, right? So it was about early 90s. So how I look at it is, if you are now hiring someone around 2007, let's say, to deal with autism at the high school, that means maybe there's been a bunch of cases prior to that, right? That you're realizing, especially at the elementary school level. So I would say, beyond any doubt, that we started to see stuff around 2005. And because we saw stuff at 2005, that means around 1990 is where this began.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that fit, That fits with my experience for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had disappeared on me. I don't know on me, but you mentioned taking a break in 2017. What's going on?
Life. I think it was a number of things. Like I had mentioned earlier and alluded to earlier, I was very much the person like, the house is on fire, let's put this fire out. And I was just full speed ahead from the moment that I knew something was wrong. And at the same time, I had another child. So I'm the mother of three. I'm working full time. I went back for two graduate degrees. I'm advocating on a national level by this point for raising money for multiple different organizations. And I just burned myself out, to be quite honest. And simultaneously, my personal life just really, really fell apart, which is not uncommon when you are in this situation. I certainly would never say that it was exclusive to this situation. It wasn't at all. But just everything started coming to a head. And as I was examining the things in my life that I could responsibly back away from to just ease my stress and focus on what I needed to focus on, advocacy had to be the thing that that had to be the thing that had to go. And I just needed a break. If you recall, 2015 was right when the measles outbreak happened at Disneyland. And we had all been anticipating that something for a while, something was going to happen that organized the medical industrial complex was going to latch onto as an excuse to just eradicate exemptions. Because the only way you could assert as a parent that you were distrustworthy of the vaccination schedule and vaccines at that point was to just not vaccinate. So that was the only way you could really deal with it. We knew they were going to put the kibosh on that. And so as soon as the measles episode happened, we saw this sweeping legislation just move throughout the country. I was very involved in that. I was a part of the Trace Amounts documentary, which is fabulous. If anybody hasn't watched that, they need to watch that. But I was consulting for that. I was traveling around the country with that group of people. I was working closely with Bobby Kennedy. And so I got to see firsthand that this was becoming extremely political. That this was no longer just a medical medical consumer issue. This was a political issue. And you could see very clearly this was becoming a partisan issue. And all of that, like I said, just it became so heavy. It just became so much that I needed to step back for a little while.
Yeah. Glad you did, because I've done the same thing after 4 years of battling with the medical board. And it wears you down. And you have to take care of yourself so you can be of use to your family and then also to society, which what brought you back into my world was reading your article about Paul Oosterhuis. And I understand I'm going to get him on the show, folks. And you're going to help me, Julie.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think you have some familial ties. So maybe tell us a little bit, just a little intro to pique people's interest on this guy.
So this is just crazy coincidence, right? And just like my book, but this is a fortunate coincidence, not an unfortunate coincidence. Paul happened to be married to my first cousin. Paul is a cardiologist, anesthesiologist, sorry, Paul, in Australia. And I've only met him in person once. When my cousin ended up moving to Australia, it's not like she gets back a whole lot. So it was probably about, 11 or 12 years ago that they came in for a family wedding and I got to meet him. And at that point in time, I certainly wasn't ever openly discussing my views on vaccination and autism with people that I didn't have to. That's walking into a minefield. And certainly, at least for me, that wasn't something that I would begin a conversation with. And so I know we didn't talk about it at all. And I'm close with my cousin still on social media, and we talk and keep up through my mom and all sorts of stuff. And it was right during COVID, maybe 2021, I can't remember, that she started telling me that Paul was getting in trouble in Australia for speaking out on social media about what he was seeing regarding the COVID pandemic and the way that it was being treated and handled and so forth. And so I just started following him a little bit and getting to know more about his position. And we were extremely like-minded. And then understanding that he ended up losing his medical license because of his social media posts, which were basically calling out the politicians and the medical boards for what their policies were. And then he ended up getting it back, being able to take it all the way to the Supreme Court and getting it back. So I knew it was, when did I talk to him? That was almost a year ago that we talked, that I wrote that article. So I knew in 2022, I was like, I got to talk to him. So I reached out and he was very open and we had a wonderful conversation, and that's how that all started. So yeah. Just a small world more than anything.
Yeah. He shares, you write well about it. And where can people go actually to read your article about this?
So two places. It first appeared on Children's Health Defense, and then it was republished on Age of Autism.
Perfect. Yeah, I read that article. It was like, wow. This is a physician, a doctor, an MD, who was in critical care. He had multiple subspecialties. His main one was anesthesiology. But he was working in hospitals and seeing what was happening, boots on the ground with COVID, and watched in Australia how they rounded up 20,000 kids and vaccinated them. I remember reading that in the news. But boy, our news was crickets about the fact that they had a million people, I think it was, two separate occasions protesting, something like that.
Yep.
And you don't even hear about it here.
No, but because of it doesn't fit the narrative, right? It doesn't support the idea that there's some sort of collective support for everything that has happened. It's really quite the opposite. Anybody who has just conversations with people in their circle, their colleagues and so forth, it's rare to find somebody who's, yes, everything was handled beautifully and it was wonderful, and I think we should do that again. And there are people like that, but it's far less common.
So I learned just before we got on this interview that you also wrote about a local mortician, mm-hmm. what he's been experiencing. And that's something I've been intrigued about. I wish somebody would just go in and talk to all the morticians, because if the vaccine is causing death, they're going to see it.
Yes. So in another coincidence, if you will, my family, my parents happen to be very good friends with a mortician who has been in our area, in the Chicagoland area, for his entire life. This has been his family's business. So he has not been around dead bodies since he was pretty much a child. And he's now in his 60s or 70s. So this is someone that I was like, I want to know. I want to talk to him. And he was extremely open about it. And so my article, again, is on Age of Autism. It's called Interview with an Undertaker. But he was, again, very measured, and he very surprising. Well, for example, he told me that the suicide rate, which I had expected to be amongst younger people, was not, that the suicide rate was escalating between 30 and 50 year olds. That was really where the spike was. But the biggest thing that he saw was something I had not even heard about. And subsequently, since, I've heard a lot about it, which is, when you're preparing a body, and this is just for everybody to be, but it's a little, make you a little squeamish, but they have to drain the body and then they have to embalm the body. And when you're draining the body, blood clots will come out. But for the very first time ever, he was getting white, bifurcated arterial blood clots that they were yanking out of body. This had never happened before. He had never seen these before. And so that for him was the alarm, was that this was all since COVID, particularly since the vaccination that was being not just seen by him, but has been seen by multiple morticians who have been reporting the same things.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
Yeah. I attended a conference and Ryan Cole, who's a pathologist, had samples that he was showing us. It's this thick, rubbery white cord. Some of them as large as your little pinky. When I was in college, I actually, to save money, I lived in a mortuary, and I was part of the coroners. We would go pick up the bodies, bring them to the mortuaries. I watched many embalming procedures, and you're absolutely right. You're draining the blood out, and then you're putting in formaldehyde, which just preserves the body. And yeah, there were no clots. This is something totally new. And we pretty much understand now why the COVID jab is triggering clotting of a very bizarre nature, something that's never been seen before. So that is confirms.
Yeah, so those two things, it was nice to take a break for a little while. It really was, but it's not in my nature to stay quiet. I'm just not wired that way. Without being funny, I do feel a very deep sense of responsibility. Like I said, you can't unsee this. Mm. And it is a lonely road. You do find really wonderful people along the way. I have met some of the most remarkable people and become friends with some absolute heroes. But it's hard. It's definitely hard. It was never lost on me a long time ago that you could be putting your job at risk by speaking out. You're definitely putting relationships at risk. You're putting your reputation at risk. This isn't an easy road to go down. But once I had a little break from it, got my life in a place where I felt pretty confident again, I was very comfortable going back and saying, okay, I think there's still some stories to tell here. I think there's still some things to talk about. And that was one of them. And then definitely Paul was the other.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that. And I love when you say that you can't unsee what you've seen, because I've said the same thing for a couple decades now. You can't unknow what you can't unsee what you've seen. What are you supposed to do? And thankfully, what I think COVID helped push this to the forefront is that those folks who were ethical realized, even if it meant you were going to lose your life or your career, you didn't have a choice. Our children, our society, our world is depending on those of us who have enough courage to just speak what we're seeing and what we know to be, so that those who have their eyes clouded by mainstream media that's just a propaganda machine that's pulling the wool over people's eyes, they don't know what they don't know. And it's on us to help them become aware.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that's all you can do is you can put the information out there. And if they choose to receive it, they do. If they don't, but like you said, to put your head down on the pillow at night and to be able to sleep and to be able to know that you have information that can help people. It's a responsibility. It's a responsibility.
So before I have Dee Dee come chat with you, and boy, you guys I know are going to have a great chat. You have also, I think, been involved in politics to some extent. What do you think, what's our course forward at this point? I know we can't on this program endorse any candidate, okay? Because my show is on CHD TV, for example, and RFK Jr. is running. So obviously we're not endorsing any candidates, but
sure,
you can certainly speak to what you think is important for our world to know moving forward.
It's interesting. I think that it's becoming a part of people's consciousness. There are two acts in particular that I think are responsible for why we are where we are. The first one is a lesser known act, and I might mispronounce the person's name. It's spelled B-A-Y-H, and I don't know if it's pronounced Bay or Ba, so I apologize. But it was Bay Dole Act of 1980. It was signed by Jimmy Carter. And this was the act that legalized public-private partnerships. Mm. And public-private partnerships are directly responsible for why so many of our institutions have been captured by private industry. There's just absolutely no doubt about it. So if you want to make the argument that in theory, this was a wonderful idea to incentivize people at public universities to be able to be rewarded financially for their discoveries, I understand that, and I really do. But unfortunately, it took a very wrong turn. And what it actually ended up doing, in my opinion, is it took government being a partner of the consumer. Government's supposed to have our back. It's supposed to be for us. Mm-hmm. And so it should have been a fair fight of government and consumer versus provider and product maker. But it took the government and put it on their side. So it's legitimately the consumer versus the government versus the industry and versus the provider. They create all the legislation to protect themselves, and they fund all the industry or all the science and everything else to exonerate themselves. And then people stand back and go, see, they proved it didn't happen. It's obnoxious. And to me, that's one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough, is that needs to be amended in some capacity, if it's possible, or abolished. That's number one. But number two is the one that I have seen more people talking about, which is the 1986 Act of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. The fact that program exists tells us beyond any doubt that vaccination is capable of ruining a life and taking a life. Our only fight has ever been over the scale. That's it. So it is not up for debate that vaccines can hurt people. It's not up for debate that they can help people. But then the issue is, how many people have been hurt? Who are the people that can be hurt? And are the right policies, procedures, and systems in place and people in order to fairly and ethically determine what that is? And I don't think that is the case at all. And yep. Again, I believe that's why we're here. So yeah. Politically, for me, anybody who is cognizant of those two pieces of legislation and likewise understands the seriousness with which they must be addressed so that liability can be restored, because with liability comes trust.
Yeah.
As long as right now, as a parent, I used to say this, I am the only one liable for what happens to my child when I give them a vaccine. I am the one liable. I have to live not only financially, potentially, medically, potentially, but I have to live emotionally, spiritually. I bear that burden the rest of my life. The yeah. government doesn't care. They're not going to do anything for my child. They're going to make it impossible for me to even prove what happened. So as long as that liability rests on the consumer, and this is for everyone, not just a parent, as long as that liability rests on the consumer, it is the consumer's decision. And if yep. they want to bear the liability, they want to join in, then that will build trust. And if I know there's a safety net there, I'm happy to jump into there. Or at least I'm more willing to, let's put it that way. But until then, I'm out.
Yep. So. And that's the whole basis of informed consent that's been destroyed by vaccine mandates.
Yes.
Right? So you have a product that is free of all liability that's being mandated. And as you just pointed out so eloquently, you, the parent or the consumer, bears all the burden of harm, right?
Yes.
With nowhere to go for any kind of compensation for your loss.
Or so, even medical help.
Yep.
I always make this analogy to people, and I stand by it, which is, if somebody lit my house on fire and I called up the fire department and said, hey, my house is on fire. And they said, where did it start? And I said, well, a smoke alarm or something backfired, or somebody lit it on fire. And they said, those people don't light it on fire, and smoke alarms are good. Smoke alarms don't do bad things. And you're still standing there going, yeah, I hear you, but it's on fire. What do you want me to do? And they don't show up.
Right.
They don't show up. What do you do as a parent? You're going to grab the hose. You might grab the sink water. Heck, you might grab the toilet water. And then to stand there for years and be told, hey, toilet water is a really bad way to put out a fire. I know. I know. But no one showed up for the fire. So what do you want me to do? It's like that. It's just, until the system is fixed, I don't see this getting any better. It's going to get worse, actually.
Yeah. On that note, I'm bringing Dee Dee in so you guys can have a heart-to-heart, woman-to-woman.
Okay.
Take it to the next level here. Thank you, Julie.
Yes.
We need you in this movement, and I'm so glad you're back.
Thank you. I've been so happy to be on. It's great to see you and that you're doing well.
Hi, Julie. Thank you for joining me. So the book you're writing, was your third child that was written about?
My second child.
Second child. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
Yeah.
So how long in between when you met this wonderful man that you're with? Was he part of the medical freedom?
No, not at all. And actually, that's a funny story. Unfortunately, my ex and I were on wonderful terms. We're good with one another. My ex and I, we just struggled for a while. It was not an acute separation. It was something that we struggled with for a very long time. So it felt like a slow Band-Aid coming off. And when it was finally time for things to end permanently, that was in 2017. And I was at the lowest I've ever been in my entire life at that.
Was that break time that Doc
was talking
about?
It was. I was probably the most involved in advocacy that I had ever been. I had been tapped on the shoulder to do a lot of amazing things, just amazing things. This with all of my heart. I certainly never went into this expecting anything. I didn't want notoriety. It was the exact opposite. But people found value in what I had to say, and I understood that, and I take it seriously, and I do. Paul and I had talked about it. You can't unsee this, and I felt a deep responsibility to be involved. But I was having a hard time where to say no, where to say yes, boundaries, all of that stuff. And so it was not only right then that my marriage ended, it was also then that I just severed ties completely with the advocacy world, which, right or wrong, was pretty abrupt. And I sometimes am a little bit, I don't want to say ashamed, but I feel badly about the way I just was like, I'm out. But that's actually how it happened. I was really on the verge of a breakdown, to be quite honest. Didn't have a job, just figuring out, what am I going to do moving forward? And I spent quite a while, almost a year, feeling very sad, very depressed, and very lost. And it was a family member who just really had enough of that and was like, was very kind, but also very stern, and was like, you're a beautiful woman. You have a lot to offer someone, and you have a whole life ahead of you. And I know that this has been hard and all that, but you need to get back out there, go on a date. And he was harassing me about it. And I ended up putting a profile up, which, that was the first time I had stepped into the online dating world, which is a lawless land. That if you're,
yes,
if
I know,
dated in the 90s. If last time you ever dated someone was the early 90s, to go on to that, that's pretty great. So we met there, and I'll be honest, I was apprehensive, I guess is the right word, about how am I going to explain this part of my life? If he does a search on me really quickly, there are people who have not said nice things about me. And so how am I going to explain this? But to be quite honest, I think, and this is the case for the most part, I think I have always overestimated how much people pay attention to this issue. I think I've also overestimated, and maybe not anymore since COVID, but definitely at the time, but I also overestimated that I think so many more people are on the side of reason and on the side of really knowing something's not right, even if they don't know exactly what it is. And so he was very open-minded. He was very supportive. Yeah. And he always has been. And so it was easy. And I gave him my book, like maybe a few dates in. I had told him I wrote a book, and he had mentioned he might want to read it. And so I brought it because I really wanted to just be transparent. I really wanted to just be like, look, this is who I am. This is my story. And likewise, I did have a child with special needs, and putting yourself out there again and saying, hey, by the way, it takes a special person to be okay with that and to embrace that. And he has been absolutely extraordinary. Just, he's a remarkable person and extremely blessed. Yeah.
Okay, that's awesome. When did you get married?
We were married on September 3rd of 2022.
Yay. Okay.
That's a little over a year.
I don't know if you want to talk about this. There's two things that I want to approach. First, I want to talk about the naysayers, the people who, and not just friends and family, who all of a sudden, which we've dealt with that. I've really dealt with that. And I still deal with it. But just people who you don't even know making judgments or saying things. And like you said, if he looked you up, there would be this maybe massive information on things that don't look so great about you.
Right.
Do you say to those people now, and how did that affect you? Because it does affect us.
It always affected me. It's affected me very deeply. I am an extremely sensitive person. I feel things very deeply. I've never been good at just being able to block things out. But again, it was just always walking that line between what I felt was a moral responsibility coupled with trying to protect myself. Early on, in way, way back 20 years ago, when I was on a Yahoo group, I was simply sharing anecdotal evidence from my school. I never named my school. I never named a student. It was never anything like that at all. But I was simply saying, we only have X amount of this and what have you. And that somebody who had been anonymous on the Yahoo group took the time to contact my administration and made an effort to harm me professionally. This was 2005. And so I have always been acutely aware of that we were poking a bear, that there was, because for somebody to be on a random Yahoo chat room with parents, it was very odd. So yeah, so I do my best to just keep my head down and focus straight ahead. I've always tried to conduct myself and speak and write very responsibly, very rationally. If I'm wrong, I'll say I'm wrong. If somebody wants to get into some sort of insult competition, I'm not going to be a part of that. If we want to talk about the actual issue and we disagree, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to get into the weeds of personal attacks and things like that. And I can only control myself in that regard. And whatever other people want to do is whatever other people want to do.
But you pointed out something that I wish more people would pay attention to, too, is that we are willing to listen. The other side isn't. They always say there's two sides to every story. And I'm learning in this whole thing, there's three sides. Because there are people that sit in the middle of this, and we have to pay attention to everybody and their feelings. And that's what Dr. Paul and I talk a lot about, is that communication piece. And because you're so calm and loving and sensitive, it allows you to be a great communicator and be out there and sharing what you're sharing. And you've impacted a lot of lives, yet it impacts you too. And so I think that's the thing. And I encourage you to, I think I'm older than you, so I'm at a point now, it's whatever. I don't care what people think anymore. You're right. We have a mission. We have something we have to do. And just because they think something about us doesn't mean that's the truth. And it certainly isn't our truth.
So I think it also helps something that I realized a very long time ago, and I meet this very sincerely. We're not really dealing with a scientific battle. This isn't a scientific battle, believe it or not. This is a religious battle. This is a battle of beliefs. Vaccination has been taught to generations of people now as being the greatest thing that man has ever done. That this is that we, for the first time, have been able to control Mother Nature without consequence. That's the story. That's what we've been told. And then if there are any consequences, they're worth it. And that it is just a part of being alive, that this is what you have to deal with. And that is something I believed. That is what we were taught. That is what we were indoctrinated with that. So you're talking about not only just having, maybe you are going to deal with the science on some level, but it's so much deeper than that. You're dealing with a belief system.
Right.
And getting to the bottom of that and saying, what if that's not true? And what if there have been consequences, but those consequences have not been accurately studied or appropriately studied or shared, or they have been studied and they've hidden the data and things like that. So I've always just tried to keep that in mind, is that when you are challenging people's core beliefs, and this has happened to me as well, I can relate. Your blood pressure goes up, your throat might get a little tight. It's difficult to stay in the calm, right? It's difficult to stay there. So I think so much of what we're experiencing a lot of times is really just that initial resistance to challenging that core belief.
Right. And I think for some too, I know for me, I don't even know that it was necessarily a belief. That's something you did. I had a baby later, and you just go in and this, I didn't even realize that it was even a thing. I think that's the thing, is now that, especially with COVID, it's been brought to that light. Okay, so there's so much I want to ask you.
I'm fine.
So looking back now, one of the questions I always ask is, what would you do differently? If you could go back to your childhood, would you pick a different career knowing what you know now? Obviously, you would not vaccinate your children. But what do you, if there's a young person out there now that's trying to decide, do I go into education? What's the most important thing I can do right now to affect the world career-wise? What would you tell them?
Oh my goodness. Career-wise? Yeah, definitely education. We are in a crisis in education with a shortage of educators, but for understandable reasons. So I say that as a double-edged sword, because there are serious reasons why people are leaving education in all of its glory. But it's an amazing profession. And even if you only do it for a little while, I think it's one of the most profound ways that you can impact lives. However, like I said, for a lot of other reasons, it's one of the most challenging things and most challenging positions that you could ever have. But honestly, I really do believe this. I believe that you can find something sacred in any profession, that if you find a way to make your profession of service, and if you really distinguish it that way, right? This is what I help people do. I help people, for example, even if you work in a bank, I help keep people's money safe. I help people have an organized home. Whatever it is, if you can find whatever that sacredness is of that particular profession, I think that you can do anything, to be quite honest. But I also think, in regards to this issue, I think the most important thing is you just have to be informed. I think it was Michael Schellenberger, who I follow. He's a journalist, and he's been just really fascinating to follow in his pursuit of uncovering the censorship industrial complex and things like that. And I'm just going to paraphrase, but he said something along the lines of, we're past the days of the truth coming to us. There was a time. There was a time. And you and I were alive for it. There was a time you could turn on the television or open a newspaper and the truth was there. It was unbiased. It was simply fact. And it was left to the reader to determine where you stood on that issue. But nobody was trying to coerce you or trying to
force.
Yeah, or to brainwash you in some way. But those days are gone. We now have to go find the truth. And so that would probably be my biggest thing to young people would be, you have to go find the truth. It is no longer going to come to you. You have to understand the systems that are in place that are trying to get you to think a certain way, believe a certain way, that who have monetized information in a way that we've never seen before in humanity. And the results are what they are, the division and the confusion and so many things. Yeah. So I don't know if that's what I would suggest.
Are your two graduate degrees that you talked about, I heard you tell Paul, are those in education?
They are. So I have, my first is in teaching and leadership and my second is in educational administration.
Wow, that's awesome. That's incredible. I can see you getting even more.
I'm interested. I want to get more. I love to learn. I'm one of those people. I never want to stop learning.
And the more we learn, the better we teach.
Yep.
My last question, because you answered, I'm guessing you wouldn't do anything differently. You'd still be the amazing teacher that you are now, is what my guess is. One thing you talked about a little bit, and I don't know if this will be on the show or not, but if you don't mind sharing,
sure.
There's so many of us that are in the medical freedom. And you talked about everything you were going through. You stepped out because of the breakdown or almost having a breakdown. Have it. Can you talk to people? Just say something, and especially I think it seems to affect a lot of moms too, when you're going through all these, say, have children, the marriage, all of that. What does a breakdown feel like? What happened for you?
I didn't honestly know what anxiety was. I never really thought about it, so I didn't have a label for it, but I definitely remember standing in my room one day, folding laundry and shaking my hands and going, why am I still afraid all the time? That's all I could feel was fear. I didn't realize that was anxiety. I know that sounds silly, but I just felt afraid. And it was like that. For me, it was just the level of that, the intensity of that fear, I guess you could say, that anxiety just kept going up and up and up. And I would vacillate between profound feelings of fear like that, and then profound feelings of sadness and depression. And then I would get into deep despair and guilt. Something would happen with my daughter or any of my children, and I would ruminate over all the ways that I had failed them or all the things that I shouldn't have done or should have done. I was very much caught in all that. And then simultaneously, without getting too personal about my ex, it's his story. He was really struggling in a lot of ways, very serious ways. And all of that together, being involved in this issue, teaching full time, being a mother of three children, carrying the entire mental load for all of them. I was completely in charge of my whole household, everything from the cooking, the cleaning, everything. I was also volunteering for everything that I possibly could, going back to school, writing a book. It was pretty nuts. And I did have friends of mine. One of my best friends was like, she would say, I don't know how you do it, but she wasn't saying it in a complimentary way. She was saying it, but she was saying, I think something's going on. Like,
right.
You need to slow down. Like, something is happening here. So my breakdown just really just felt just like the word sounds, where it was, I just couldn't do it anymore. It was just, that was it. I tapped out. It just looked like you're on a wrestling mat. It was just tapping the mat and just, I'm out. And so for me, it just became a lot of isolation, a lot of isolation. Like I said, what can I responsibly remove from my plate? What can I responsibly remove from my life to calm my nervous system down, to be able to be in a headspace where I can make responsible decisions for my family? Because I've done a lot of things in the meantime to get in a good space, but I've really come to learn that when you are in a state of fight or flight, when you are there, you are not your best mom. You are not your best advocate. You are not your best teacher or best whatever, because you're living in survival mode. And a lot of the guilt I was feeling was because I knew I was parenting from survival. And I didn't want to live that way anymore. So unfortunately, I honestly just think that life will bring you there. Like, you can try to keep going as far as you want, but a point will come where it's going to grab you and it's going to take control and you're going to have to deal with it. And you can't run anymore and you can't do too many things anymore. You've got to face it. So that's what it was for me, for sure.
And you do too. I want to point out a couple of things, and hopefully it helps other people too, because this is something that I coach on. I work with a lot of adults and doctors that go through so much, and whether it's losing a license or whatever it is, that depression, all those little pieces. You'd made a comment that you felt bad about how fast you stepped away and maybe what you left in the wake, but your stepping away is what saved your life. That's the thing I think for so many people. I don't know what your depression was like, but I've heard of so many parents that it was very close to life ending. Suicide became thoughts because it's like, I can't do anymore. And if I can't do all the things I want to do or all the things that are important, why the hell am I here? And when that happens, and I don't know if that happened for you, but when that happens for so many people, that's the thing is you have to figure out, we don't have to do everything. And why we think we do, I don't know. But that's in us, right? We're moms. We're supposed to do all those things. And if somebody else is relying on us, we have to be there for them. But if you're not taking care of yourself, and if you're not putting yourself and your health first, you will not be able to do that for other people. So no. I really have much mad respect for you for being able to say, hey, I have to step back. I have to do something else. And you have children, and that comes first. I always joke my title is just a mom, because first and foremost, that's what I am.
That, going back to what I would tell young people, I really mean this with all my heart. I think that, again, we're the daughter of the post-feminist generation, at least I am. And that message that we could do anything, be anything, have anything, okay, that got through crystal clear. But we did not get the message that we didn't have to do everything else at the same time. And so I didn't abandon any of the traditional roles and so forth. If anything, it was like, okay, let me throw a career on top of this at the same time. And I'm not going to ask for help, because why would you ask for help? I didn't even know how to ask for help. Don't get me wrong. I had wonderful family and my mom and my grandmother and people help, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
I do.
And on an internal level, there was just, that was not even on my radar to not do the things that I was doing. Of course I had to clean the house. Of course I had to be the responsible one for dinner every night. Of course if I could go back and do it over again, and you asked me about this earlier, I really mean this with all of my heart. I would have given anything to be a full-time mom. Anything to just to have focused all of my effort on that. I think that, I don't know, I feel like if I had realized I could have easily stayed home full time 15 years or more and had a whole lifetime to still go get a degree and have a career, I think I would have approached things very differently. But no, I just think that the message has been, at least for Gen X, that message was not only that you should be doing all the things that your mother did, but now all these other things, because these opportunities are there. I think that it really caused a lot of suffering that could be avoided for other women in the future, for sure.
And you just answered the question that I asked earlier, even more clearly, is that looking back, what would you do differently? And for you to say that, to put kids first or whatever. We don't think about it though. The career, all the things you were doing, the intent is to provide for our family and to do better for our kids. But I think that is why so many people are choosing to homeschool or maybe to be able to stay home. And I did for a long time. I worked my whole life around making sure that I was there for him before and after school. And that's the thing though, is that everyone has to make those choices for themselves, right? So I love that you said there would be things that you would do differently. I think sometimes we think, sure, Oh no, I have to say I wouldn't do anything different.
No, I don't think that if you look back on, I don't think anyone reflecting on their life would ever say they ever did anything perfectly. Or, I don't know, on the one hand, if you'd made different choices, you're not where you are right now. So of course, I wouldn't want to change those things. But if I could have prevented some of the challenges and suffering for myself and for other people that I loved, if there was some way to have done that and still ended up where I am, sure, I would do that, of course.
But don't you think that's the point of sharing and writing your book and all those things is that you did go through it? We wish we didn't. We wish we would have known all those things so that we wouldn't have, our children wouldn't have those issues. But the point is, that's why we share. And that's why we do the work that we do.
I would also say too, anybody who's younger that's got a child, particularly with special needs, I try not to call them regrets anymore because I don't like to live in that space. I can't do anything about the past. And I know with all of my heart that I've always done the very best that I could. They were legitimate things that needed to be fixed. So I'm not talking about changing her soul or her personality or anything like that. I'm talking about the medical things that were going on with her. But I feel like I wasn't present for so many of the things that I wish I would have been, where my body was there, my mind was there, but rather than being in a party and thinking about and just making a memory with her. Does this have gluten? Does this have this? Does this have, how is she compared to this 5-year-old? I just wish I could go back and just be at peace, or just be at a little bit more peace with her and with my life at the time. Because I feel like I missed a lot of that. I really do.
And again, this is all great information for those that aren't there yet to do it. And we always say that, we always tell new moms, just be focused on your baby. Don't worry about house cleaning or all those things. That has to go through life. We all do look back and go, wow, I wish I would have done something a little differently or been there more. I'm glad that you said that. I also am very proud of you. I feel like your big sister. Very proud of you for understanding that it doesn't serve anybody for you to stay in a place of regret or guilt. We have to move forward. And it was my child that said, you didn't do this to me. The vaccine did this to me. And so remembering that, and like you said, that's, I think, the part of being in this movement is to take what we know now and what we wish we would have done and share it with others. So maybe they learn from it and can do things differently. But I love that you don't hang on to that, because that can destroy a person.
I try not to. If I'm very mindful of it now, I'm very conscious of it, and I worked very hard, I'm still vulnerable to those moments. If my affected daughter is struggling with something, it's very easy to go down that rabbit hole. It's very easy, but I'm much, much better at stopping it.
Nope. Good.
We're not doing that. I'm not going back to 2007 to think about what I did or didn't say or do. You know, that's over. We're not doing that anymore. But it's a process. It's definitely a process.
It is a process. And you mentioned something that you had friends and family during that time of that breakdown. That's what Kids First Forever, the program that Dr. Paul and I have, we both wellness coach, because that's the point of that, is that we all go through things. We all have tough times making decisions about vaccines. There's so much happening. And when you're in that moment, sometimes it is, even for me, it's hard to reach out to family or friends, because those are the ones that are relying on us, right? There's other people out there who can help. I think that's what happens still in our society now, is that when something happens like it did for you in your world and you got overwhelmed, a lot of people hit that depression and they go to the doctor and they get put on meds to help with that. And I don't think that's the answer. If we had somebody to talk to who wasn't judgmental, who wasn't biased, any of that, that gives you a place to share those things. So that's something I'd like to share, is if people find themselves in the situation like you were in, Julie, that it's okay to reach out and ask for that outside help. It doesn't mean that you're failing. It doesn't mean that you're wrong. It just gives us support that can be that piece to help you through it.
Yeah. And I think I was also very blessed from a very young age. I've been a runner, and I don't run more than 3 or 4 miles at a time, a couple of days a week. But I've done that for probably 35 plus years. Likewise, I've always been a journaler. I have journaled forever. So I really credit, to be honest, those two things. And yes, I've had wonderful friendships and support and so forth. But the combination of exercise with journaling, a lot of prayer, good friends, and just an insatiable curiosity, always. Like, I'm just an extremely curious person. always.
Right.
I always want to get to the bottom of something. So I really spent a very long time reading and researching and going to therapists and learning everything that I possibly could so that I do understand it, because I do think there's power in understanding. I really do, at least for me. I needed
to understand it.
And understanding it was really the foundation of where then I was able to be conscious about the choices and decisions and the behaviors that I was going to choose instead moving forward. And it's just, it's been life changing, but whoa, man, what a reckoning. Total reckoning.
It's awesome. And it's funny, you mentioned when I do coach somebody going through, that's the first thing I say is, not besides nutrition and all those things, but the power of exercise. And I always mention sleep too, because I think when we're going through a lot, we don't get the good sleep that we need. But the exercise and the journaling, prayer, all those things are so important. And I'm so glad that you had those. And I'm so glad that you are where you are. I cannot wait to read your next book, because I know there's another one coming.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I actually did put a proposal forth recently. So we'll see. But yeah, thank you. Yeah, wherever it ends up like that, I really mean that with all my heart. From the very beginning, when I started speaking out on the Yahoo chat room, and then that evolved into being asked to be a part of a blog, and then that evolved to being a part of a documentary, and that evolved to working for Bobby. And it's just always, it's been wild how that's gone. So we'll see. I'm open to
see it. I see it already. So we'll just go with that, because I need to read it probably. Thank you very much for joining us and being a part of this, and keep doing all your hard work. And if you ever need a sounding board, I'm here for you.
Okay. Thank you. It's been great meeting you and seeing Paul again. And I'm thrilled that you guys had me on. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hey everyone. It's me, Dee Dee, coming to you from my soul. Today in my interview with Julie, it really touched my heart and my soul, because listening to her story and knowing what it's like to be a mom of a vaccine-injured child, it touches your soul. When we're dealing with something that is something we didn't cause, but maybe a decision of something that we made, it hurts. But in our souls, we have to reach in deep and know that having faith in a higher power and having faith in our children's ability to allow their bodies to heal, that's powerful. So my soul was very touched by her and her story, and knowing how great it is to be a mom, even in the toughest of situations, especially when we lead from our souls. Thanks for watching.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.